I've called my talk this evening A Sense of Wonder. Have you ever looked into the trumpet of a daffodil, or perhaps smelled a rose in the evening after the rain has fallen? Have you ever got up early and listened to the dawn chorus? And a little later on, have you ever heard that incredible hush which comes across the world at that time? If you have looked and smelled and listened in these ways, you'll know that there is unquestionably something special and mysterious about the world we live in. The natural world is a marvel of beauty and of intricate patterns, all of which seem to interlink with one another. Every leaf, every tree, every bird, every insect, every flower, all seem to live in a perfect balance with one another. Man, too, is a part of it, although there are some who would dispute that. If you turn your attention outwards, towards the far reaches of space, there are more wonders to be seen. Planets circle distant suns, there are distant galaxies, all of which form an harmonious pattern, working to its own intricate laws. Or if you turn your attention inward toward the world of the atom and the molecule, there too one finds another universe of mystery and order. Indeed, we can say that the entire universe, from the most minute to the most incredibly large, is one vast network of interlinked patterns. Pondering on these things can give rise to a sense of wonder about this world we inhabit. It seems so wonderful, it seems so intricate, it seems so marvelous. Some, looking for the origins of things, believe there must be an omnipotent being who, they say, must have created the universe in the beginning. But we are taught in Buddhatamma, the way of the Buddha, that to look for first beginnings is futile. Whichever way you do it, it boils down in the end to the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg? If you say, well, clearly it must have been an egg, then where did the egg come from? There must have been a chicken to lay it. But if the chicken was first, where did it come from? It must clearly have come from an egg. And so you go on back and back in what's called an infinite regress, driving yourselves slowly mad with your attempt to find a first beginning. And yet there is unquestionably something behind it all. Everyone who has observed the wonders of the world, small or large, anyone who ponders deeply on the majesty and mystery of the universe around us, everyone becomes convinced, becomes certain that there is something beyond the reach of the intellect, that there is an unformed infinite behind it all somewhere, that there is, as the Buddha called it, an unborn, uncreate, unbecome. All religious teaching is an attempt to show people how they may come to know this beyond, this perfection, for themselves. In the best cases, people can follow a path which actually leads to direct experience of this something behind the phenomenal world. Any effective way will always have the accent on a spiritual dimension to life, not on the material universe. For to get to this beyond of things, we have to somehow transcend the gross physical body, this earthy body of ours, and moreover, we have even to transcend the abstract reaches of the mind. For, although this body is clearly material, many people would consider that the mind is something quite different. But much mental substance is merely refined materiality. Go further, and we're still dealing with worldly matters, albeit rather tenuous. We're still dealing with substance. And that beyond we seek is in fact beyond every aspect of body and mind, however gross, however subtle. So what is this beyond? If you've never actually smelled a rose, then consider how you might come to know what a rose smells like. No description helps. People can tell you at length, trying to describe the smell of a rose. It doesn't help. No amount of thought given to it actually gives you a clue. No picture can help. No photograph. Gardening books are a complete waste of time. You have to put aside all of these things, ideas, thoughts, pictures, photographs, reference books. You have to put aside all these things and smell the rose for yourself. So too with the beyond. The beyond is, quite literally, beyond all normal experience. Only when the mind turns away from the usual and the familiar can there be any chance of finding out what the smell of the infinite actually is. The perfume of the infinite is not won by logic chopping, by chasing perceptions, by trying to enhance consciousness. It is won by transcending all of these things, going beyond them entirely to the experience itself. Now, men and women have sought this beyond in many, many different ways. They've tried things like magic and alchemy. They've tried witchcraft. They've sought the beyond through prayer and meditation and through contemplation. They've sought it too through all forms of self-discipline. Whether we're talking about simple morality, leading a relatively good life, or to the extreme forms of asceticism which turn your stomach to think of them. Tonight we're going to look at a few of these ways to see how actually they do differ. And also, in the process, to accentuate how you yourselves can make the best use of the opportunities you have for treading the path to the infinite. Most people, sensing that the infinite lies beyond the material world, believe that therefore they have somehow to mortify the flesh. They have somehow to control and transcend the bodily form, to somehow pitchfork themselves into another dimension. In short, people have believed that the physical body has to be dominated ruthlessly before gnosis is possible. In Mother India, that most spiritual of lands, yogis have practiced this kind of asceticism for thousands of years. They may choose, for example, to adopt a particular posture and keep to it, not just for hours, but for days at a time. I know of one man who stood on one leg to subdue his body. He stood on one leg not just for a few hours or days, but for months, until in fact the muscles atrophied. I know of another man who his particular vision of the beyond, he took as his symbol the sun. So from dawn till dusk, he would follow the sun through the heavens with his eyes, looking straight at it. Needless to say, his eyes burned out, but he still followed the sun religiously every day, trying to subdue his body through such harsh measures. Less extreme are tales, and there are many of them, of yogis who, up in the Himalayas, live almost naked in the snows, generating their own heat through meditative discipline. Now, whilst India may be the home of such endeavours, it's not unknown in Europe and the West generally. In the Middle Ages in particular, before the dissolution of the monasteries, monks used to scourge themselves with whips, sometimes drawing blood. A Christian seeker had somehow to see himself as a sinner, and then, One of his penances to atone for this was to wear a hair shirt, again to subdue the sinful body. If he was really sincere, he would scourge himself with a whip until he drew blood, and then wear a hair shirt, which is one way of going about it. A less extreme form is now popular in the West. It's called Hatha Yoga. Hatha Yoga originated in India, of course, and the whole idea is to gain complete mastery of the physical body before it is possible then to transcend it and go on to more refined things. Of course, you can spend a whole lifetime developing such control. What then you do really is an open question. Another method of controlling the body is to fast. Fasting has been particularly popular at different times. The idea is that you purify the body so it is not so much of an obstacle to your spiritual search. And there are certain special diets which come under the same heading. All these things are asceticism of one form or another. They differ in degree, but they are all ascetic. It's unquestionably the case that they can reduce attachment to the gross physical body, although some of them, if practiced unwisely, will actually increase it. But here's the question. Can they remove attachment? They cannot. It is not possible by control alone, even ruthless control, even for years, to subdue attachment to the body entirely. Even if you have sufficiently subdued attachment to the body to live comfortably for year upon year, that attachment still lurks dormant within. Indeed, it's not stretching a point to say that excessive concern with bodily control is a measure of attachment. It shows a great and overweening concern with things physical. The teaching of the Buddha, Buddha Dhamma, avoids extremes of behavior, as I think you all know. It avoids excessive luxury and it avoids excessive asceticism. However, it does recognize the need for control, both bodily and mental. Buddha Dhamma teaches that the entire meditative life is founded upon restraint. Restraint in the first instance of behavior patterns through the precepts. Restraint, secondly, through the senses, by learning the practice of meditation and concentration. Restraint also of things like covetousness and dejection, which crowd into the mind when one's endeavors do not succeed in the way one would have wished. With mindfulness and clear comprehension, one sees that all these things have to be restrained, and that in itself is ascetic to a degree. One has to restrain the hindrances to balance the mind. But nowhere in all of this is there any hint of an extreme or excessive heavy-handedness. There is no forcing, there is no forceful heavy-handedness in the teaching of the Buddha. It is truly a middle way. But there are other ways that men have sought the infinite, other ways which concentrate more on control of the surroundings, control of the physical environment. This is much more familiar to the men of the West. Generally, we don't think to control ourselves in the first instance. Our normal reaction is to organize our environment. There is a group of disciplines all based on a desire to control or master the world around us, and it includes things like alchemy, magic, especially ritual magic, and some other things which I'll mention later. Whatever their final objective, all of these things seek to manipulate the physical universe. It is a fact that careful control of physical, mental, and emotional factors can lead into pathways that the average man is completely unaware of. It can lead to control of the actual physical surroundings through mind itself. We find actually that scientific laws are not as immutable as the scientists would have us believe. The material universe is very much more responsive to our desires than most people expect. Look at alchemy as a for instance. Okay, it's an age-old discipline now, and it used a language disguised heavily to prevent it being understood precisely what was going on. But alchemy did not seek the philosopher's stone to turn lead into gold, as so many people believe. Actually, they sought to transmute earthly experience into the experience of the infinite. They sought to transmute physical lead, into spiritual gold. One of their methods of reducing attachment to the physical universe was to repeat what we would probably think of as the same experiment hundreds, if not thousands, of times. What they found, and what in fact is found today, is that the experiment does not give the same results every time it is performed, even though the conditions seem to be identical. Modern experimenters tend to write off such experiments as spoiled for some reason they can't quite determine. But the alchemist looked for the differences and found that physical laws are not as fixed as they had thought before. This tends to reduce one's attachment to the physical world. There's rather an interesting modern example of a changeable physical law. In the big industrial boilers that used to heat water and prepare power for power stations and refineries and things like that, there was always a problem with the pipes and the boiler itself scaling up, especially in hard water areas. So periodically they had to be descaled. Today that's not such a problem because the water's deionized and doesn't leave any scale behind. But it used to be something that had to be attended to quite regularly. And there was a particular process which involved adding a chemical to the hot boiler water and then applying a small electric current to it, which would remove the scale, which afterwards would be washed out, and the whole process could start again, having saved possibly thousands of pounds which would otherwise have needed to be spent had you just carried on and actually had a breakdown. They noticed that the amount of chemical and the amount of electricity staying the same, the process of descaling took sometimes just a couple of hours and sometimes nearly 12. They examined every aspect of it and could find no apparent reason for it. Those who had a rather exploratory turn of mind started looking at things like the phase of the moon and all manner of other conditions that might conceivably affect it. They never came up, as far as I know, with a satisfactory answer. The physical universe is not as fixed as we think. Modern medicine, alternative medicine, regular medicine, they are all coming to recognize that the efficacy of treatments varies depending upon the time of the day in which the medicine is taken, day or night, and also sometimes the phase of the moon. Things change far more than ordinarily we think. This is seen particularly when we look at magic and witchcraft. The material world is not solid and unchangeable. One way to change it, indeed, is by mental power. Magicians and witches, witch doctors and shamans have always known this. The rain dance, for example, actually works. I don't know why, but it does. The anti-rain dance also works. There was an American anthropologist working in the Amazon basin, and the area where he was particularly beset by rain, being in tropical rainforest, and he was getting heartily sick of it. So he started making excuses to the people he was living among, saying that he was feeling homesick and he really couldn't stand the wet and he wanted to get away. And they said, oh, no problem. And they did an anti-rain dance. And from that day on, it didn't rain round his tent, it just rained everywhere else. How does it work? I don't know, except to say it's the power of mind applied to the physical universe. White magic, so-called, heals and helps. Black magic harms and kills. It all rests in the power of the mind, directed and sustained. That power can be augmented by ritual. Ritual magic is where you get a group of people together who actually perform some kind of ceremonial, highly emotionally charged, which liberates, if you like, lots of energy which can be directed and focused to accomplish a particular end. In this way, you can actually acquire all kinds of powers, if you have a mind to. Powers directed at controlling the physical universe. If you can really concentrate, if you can really focus your mind, then you don't actually need a group. You can develop things like mental body travel, or astral travel as some call it, telepathy, the ability to see and hear things at a distance, and so on, not to mention attracting to yourself what people, uninstructed people, call luck, good fortune, and the like. There is so much that's possible. When Westerners first landed in Australia and started to explore, especially across the central parts of Australia, they occasionally met wandering bands of Aborigines who, hundreds, indeed thousands of miles from anywhere, knew all about them. They just could not understand it. Now they know that the Aboriginals have had a method of communicating over hundreds of miles for thousands of years, presumably. They do it by telepathy. They do it by mind power alone. They pass distinct, accurate messages right across enormous distances by the power of mind alone. If one takes the trouble to develop such mental powers, it's possible to see things at a distance. It's also possible to see your own internal organs. For example, to see whether they are in good health or diseased. You see them in 3D living color. You can see things at a distance. You can see something that's going on halfway around the world if you've a mind to. And these are not fanciful notions. These are things which have actually been checked out and proved. And indeed, things which anyone can prove for themselves if they've got enough energy and drive to do the necessary practices to develop these things. The range of mind is absolutely limitless once it is concentrated and concentrated properly. You can see a pale shadow of this in the advice that Nichiren Zen gives to its followers. Chant for this, chant for that. If you chant for peace, well, that's grand. If you chant for a Porsche, that's okay too, they say. And indeed, it seems that it's not in doubt, it is entirely possible to acquire material goods by volition, mental power directed and sustained. But you would be very wise to make sure that you want what you get. Some of the things you might acquire are going to be more trouble than they're worth. The teaching of the Buddha contains comprehensive instructions for developing the magical side of the mind. If one goes that way, it's possible to develop concentration and power to the extent that you can remember your past lives, and indeed those of other people. You can come to know the thoughts of others. You can even see people die and be reborn on different levels of existence. You can develop all of the psychic powers, like travelling through the air and going through solid objects and the like. In mental body, I hasten to add, try to do it in the physical body and you end up splattered on the ground. These disciplines give first-hand knowledge of things like action and result, karma and vipaka. You can see how action in one lifetime gives a result in a future lifetime. You can see that some of your present difficulties are due to actions performed long since in a previous life. Indeed, you can see that some of your good fortune now is due to actions that you have done before. Actions of love, generosity, and kindness, they too have their results in future lives. You can see other realms, other beings. You can come to understand much more of this universe we inhabit. The magical mind is extraordinarily useful in that it gives one such a wide view and deep understanding of the relative conditioned universe. But there is with it also an enormous hazard. For these things are extraordinarily alluring, and it's very easy to get trapped in the playing with them. These powers, the magical side of the mind, they are not a necessary part of the path to enlightenment. All mental powers are, in one sense, material, insofar as they deal with worldly things. Most spiritual masters advise caution when dealing with these things, for they know full well that they can be an enormous detour, or, even worse, a complete trap for the unwary. It may well be the case that the spiritual seeker develops these powers intermittently and quite unintentionally. And it has to be said that these powers are not in any way a problem in themselves. What is a problem is the attachment to them, and that can be very deep and very strong. Conscious of the danger in powers of this kind, some people suggest that it is much better to seek a way which is more passive, that does not develop these powers. Seek a way which is based on prayer, on meditation, or contemplation. The hallmark of these ways is that they are not based on control, they are rather based on observation and self-abandonment. Prayer, meditation and contemplation are ways where the accent is on choiceless awareness. They encourage the development of gentleness and balance and steer clear of forceful domination of the body or the mind. Included in this group is a capacity for devotion. Now, devotion is a dirty word in the West, but seen rightly, it is simply a recognition of natural law. Devotion acknowledges that there is more to life than we know. It also acknowledges that life is perfect as it is, and that there is no need to change it. Such statements normally bring a howl of protests from those who follow science or humanism, or both. They constantly are concerned with things like justice and human rights. What they fail to see very often, though, is that the fighting that they do to acquire justice, to acquire human rights, is actually arising out of the very hatred and attachment that causes suffering in the first place. It's this hatred and this attachment which have to be overcome if there is to be any chance of coming face to face with the infinite. So for spiritual seekers, then, to dabble in politics and human rights is another sidetrack. It's to go back to the way of power and to forsake the way of observation. There are, in fact, many kinds of contemplation, but every one of them says that firstly, you have to understand your world. Then you can attempt some control, knowing what you're doing. It's similar in every contemplative way that there is. For example, in vipassana meditation, in Buddhism, we find the same thing. There is the accent on training, just the same, but it goes in three quite distinct stages. Firstly, we have ascetic training. It's a mild form of asceticism in that it's restraining one's worse aspects of bodily behavior by keeping to the precepts. Secondly, we have meditation itself in the form of mental training, training to control the mind, to stop it running around quite as much, to keep it calmer and quieter, to learn to focus it on a single object. Now, many of us think we can concentrate. But in fact, the level of concentration we can manage is just sufficient to read a book, or to watch a movie, or to hold a conversation, or to do a job of work. That elementary kind of concentration is no good at all for the actual control of the mind. True mental control is where you can think what you want to think, where you can hold your attention more or less on whatever you wish to hold your attention on. When that kind of concentration, that kind of restraint, that kind of control is achieved, then, most of the time, you can put aside the hindrances in meditation, and when you can do that, the mind is fit for its major task, which in some ways is the most important. The major task is the way of observation, of choiceless awareness. It is a major task, it's the most important aspect, but it would not be possible without the preceding trainings. Observation, choiceless awareness, is a question of systematically observing body and mind. One observes how hindrances arise, how they pass away. One observes how things like anger arise in the mind and pass away, how things like peace and tranquility come to be. One investigates all of these different characteristics in mind and in body and knows how they originate and how they cease. Gradually we come to see that the whole process of mind and body is conditioned. Everything that happens, happens because something else happened. If there is this present, then that arises. If this ceases, then that ceases. For example, how do you hear anything? There has to be a sound, an ear to hear, and attention and contact between the two when there will be hearing consciousness. Take away the sound, there's no consciousness. Take away the ear, there's no consciousness. Everything happens in dependence on something else. So nothing, no thing, truly comes out of nowhere. Always things arise dependent upon other things. Now if they do, and they do indeed, then these various phenomena, whether mental or physical, whether we're talking about sights or sounds or thoughts or mental pictures, whether we're talking about things like happiness, or metta, loving kindness, or hatred, or craving, none of these things can be the infinite, the beyond we seek. They are not the goal of our search. All of these things, both conventionally good and conventionally bad, none of them is the object of our search as true meditators seeking for this beyond of things. Seeing this, understanding this, the meditator can, with a clear conscience, abandon all of these relative phenomena and enter his own true home, the infinite beyond. So, after much seeking in all the wrong places, one comes to know many things. One comes to know that the beyond is nothing to do with the conditioned worlds of being, of actions and results. One comes to know that this infinite beyond does not produce things. It's not a ground of being from which things spring, as so many would claim. One comes to know that everything is void, sunya. You may have heard the term, sunyata, voidness, emptiness. All things are void of self and void of other. All things are void of separation. There is no separation, there is no distance. All things are void of form. One finds that the beyond has no power, for it never acts. It indeed is the complete absence of action. One finds that it is utter fulfillment. Its stillness and peace draw us to it because it is indeed the very end of action and not the start of it. So, seeing all these things, knowledge arises that there is no more to do, that the searching is finished, and that there is no more becoming. The Buddha put it this way. He said, birth and death is ended. Everybody hears the call of the beyond at least once in their lifetime. It doesn't matter who they are, how well-positioned or how humble, everybody hears the call of the beyond at least once. It is within everybody's power to follow it, but most do not. Most have other things to do that they consider more important. But even of those who do heed the call and seek a path, very few ever find it, for the paths are legion and often in bad repair. Those who do find a path find that they have to develop and encourage certain qualities if they are to walk it properly. They have to develop enormous courage, and they have to develop the capacity for systematic attention if they are not to slip off that path and lose their way again. They also have to discover one other thing, that it is indeed possible to overcome one's belief that craving and hatred are useful things to have. You think about it, you will only indulge your desires and your dislikes if you consider that it is worthwhile for you to do so. If you didn't consider it worthwhile, you wouldn't do it. Therefore, you have implicit faith that craving and hatred are, at those times, valuable to you. If you could see the truth, you drop them like a piece of red-hot iron. Craving and hatred have to be broken with. The only way to break with them is by following a spiritual path and coming to see for yourself, by systematic observation, by direct experience, what vicious things they actually are. Seeing that, knowing that, it's no particular problem to turn away from them. Indeed, most people run like crazy when they gradually find out what's going on. When you do overcome craving and hatred, the clinging to them, then you discover that the universe is in fact a beautiful place. And you recapture that sense of wonder that is sometimes there in the early morning or at dusk. That sense of wonder is something that can be relied upon, but it needs a lot of work to establish it as a norm. Thank you.